to that passage, 1 Kings 17 and verses 17 to 24. Last Thursday, I was in the car and was listening on the radio to the coverage of the funeral of the former football player and manager, Alan Ball, which took place in Winchester Cathedral. I was listening to the radio, and as is usual, after the death of someone famous, all manner of people were being interviewed and asked what Alan Ball would be remembered for. And of course, the obvious answer that many came up with was his part as the youngest player in the 1966 England World Cup winning squad. That would be the pinnacle of any player's career, and for Alan Ball, it came early on. Yet although many of those interviewed referred to that most public moment of triumph, some also spoke of other aspects of his life and career, things less famous, but of no lesser importance. I'm not here to speak about Alan Ball today. I'm here to continue our studies in the life and ministry of the 9th century prophet, 9th century BC prophet of the Lord Elijah. Yet my point is this: in studying Elijah, we may find ourselves, if we know something of the story of the man, we might find ourselves wanting somewhat impatiently to get to 1 Kings chapter 18, to the account of that most famous public moment of triumph on Mount Carmel, when Elijah, you might recall, he confronted the people of Israel, he challenged the prophets of Baal. There was that great triumph for him on Mount Carmel. And to many of us, that is the moment that comes to mind when we think about this man. We would regard that public victory as being the pinnacle of this prophet's career. Well, I'm not in any way going to lessen the importance of that moment in his ministry. But just as there's clearly more to remember about Alan Ball than the 1966 World Cup squad, well, on a far more significant level, there is far more to remember about Elijah and to learn from Elijah than that conquest on Carmel. The danger is that in our eagerness to get to the summit of Mount Carmel, we miss out on the peaks along the way. And yet I would argue that some of those peaks stand equally tall. There's a peak of 1 Kings chapter 17 verse 1. We might call this peak courage. Elijah going before evil King Ahab and boldly declaring, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word." What a thing to do. And then there are the peaks of 1 Kings 17 verse 5 and verse 10. We might call these peaks the peaks of obedience. For on both occasions we read how Elijah immediately, instantly obeyed the word of the Lord that had come to him, even though from a human perspective the places he was told to go to and the means by which he would be provided for were hardly what one could have anticipated. You remember the word of the Lord came to him: "Hide yourself by the brook Cherith. You shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there." Pretty unlikely. But we're told Elijah went and did according to the word of the Lord. And then the word of the Lord came to him and said, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there." This spiritually dark place outside of Israel. "I commanded a widow to feed you." But we read Elijah arose and went to Zarephath. And as we saw last time, he did in Zarephath, in that spiritually dark place, meet that widow, a Gentile widow, yet who trusted in the word of the Lord, and whose response stands in marked contrast to the response of the people of Israel at that time. Last time we saw how Israel was rejecting the word of the Lord. Elijah was obeying the word of the Lord, and then we come across this widow who believed the word of the Lord. And Elijah ends up having more in common with her than with his own people. So there are these soaring peaks on the way to the summit of Carmel. We mustn't miss them. It'd be foolish to do so. The peak of courage, the peaks of obedience. And then in today's passage, in 1 Kings 17, verses 17 to 24, we encounter another peak that we might call faith. The peak of faith. Yes, this event is perhaps less famous than that which is recorded in the following chapter. You know, if Elijah had had a funeral, which he didn't remember, but if Elijah had had a funeral and you'd ask those attending what he'd be remembered for, well, the obvious answer would have probably been then, as it is today, well, Mount Carmel. That's what that would have been, his equivalent of Alan Ball's 1966 World Cup medal. But had she been there, one voice would have said something different, I believe. And she's worth listening to. Had she been there, the widow would have said no. No, I remember him for the day he went upstairs with my dead son in his arms and came downstairs with my son alive again. That's what I remember Elijah for. And friends, though lesser known, this incident is of no lesser importance. Indeed, I believe the strength of Elijah's faith in God is displayed here like nowhere else. Like nowhere else. And I've just got three headings I want to hang our thoughts upon this morning. And firstly, we come across the unexplained death of the son. The unexplained death of the son. You know, as we continue these studies on Elijah, we really continue with the theme we looked at last time. Yes, we looked at the different responses to the word of the Lord that we see in this chapter. But alongside that, we saw last time that God's ways, though they are always marvellous, they are oftentimes mysterious from a human perspective. As William Cooper famously wrote, God moves in a mysterious way. His wonders to perform. And though we trace that theme in the earlier part of 1 Kings 17, it's nowhere more pronounced than in the opening verse of this final passage of that chapter, which we hardly touched upon last time. We read in verse 17 of 1 Kings 17, after this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. Now that statement about the son's breath leaving him, it almost takes our breath away. Because, you know, the reader is not in any way prepared for what's described in this verse. In fact, quite the opposite. We've just considered how Elijah was called to that widow's home who lived in Zarephath. He went there. She lives with what it appears to be her only child, a son. And Elijah brings the word of the Lord to her, and she trusts in the Lord of the word. And she discovers that he is unfailingly faithful to his word. What she was promised, she receives. We read in verse 16, the jar of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. Don't think that, you know, suddenly a vast quantity of flour and oil dropped from heaven into her home. It wasn't like that. Every day, day by day, she would go to the cupboard, and there was enough flour and enough oil to get them through that day. In a very visible way, she witnessed God's mercies new every morning and could declare, great is thy faithfulness. And as verse 16 draws to a close, in our minds we want to write, and they all lived happily ever after, at least until the drought ended. You know, that's what we feel. The natural conclusion is this story is every day they go until the drought's ended, and there's the oil and there's the flour. The only trouble is that's not what it says. You know, if we were in danger of falling into a delightful doze with this lovely little image of this little household quite literally feeding on God's faithfulness, we are jolted awake with a shock by the announcement that the son, the woman's son, became ill, and the illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. You know, we're given the impression that this sickness suddenly overtook the son, and before his mother knows it, before Elijah knows it, the boy is dead. There's no breath left in him. Now why? We ask, why has this happened? But no explanation is given. In fact, it's noticeable. Let me draw your attention to this. It's noticeable that the word of the Lord that we've been so used to reading in 1 Kings 17 comes to Elijah and instructs Elijah and guides Elijah. It doesn't come on this occasion. The Lord is silent. There's the corpse of the son, but no word from the Lord. Now, we sometimes hear the police say that someone has died in mysterious circumstances. And I think we could coin that phrase here. But let me make this distinction. When the police make such an announcement, they usually suspect someone of doing wrong. But my friends, here we see God at work fulfilling his good and perfect purposes, all by thoughts and ways, however, that, as he himself says in the book of Isaiah, are so far above ours that they are beyond our comprehension. Remember what God says in the 55th chapter of Isaiah. My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. To us, God moves in mysterious ways. We may be in the dark, but don't think that he is. When the brook dried up at Cherith, the food was still coming via the ravens, and we thought that was strange. You know, couldn't the God who brought the birds to bring this food to Elijah, couldn't he have kept the water flowing? Well, if yes, of course he could. He can bring water out of a rock if he so chooses. But he chose not to on that occasion. It wasn't his way of working. You know, we know what Elijah didn't know at that time. It was time for Elijah to move on. It was time to go to Zarephath. And the drying brook was God beginning that moving process. And I think we see something of a parallel situation in this passage. The food is still coming. The food is still being miraculously provided, not by ravens now, but there's this ever-filling jar of flour and jug of oil. But then we're surprised to read that it's not the food that dries up. It's the sun's breath that dries up. And we asked ourselves, why? Couldn't the God who have kept that food coming, couldn't he keep this boy alive? And the answer we have to give is, of course he could. The scriptures tell us that our breath, our life, all our ways are in God's hand. In him we live and move and have our being. A baby doesn't begin to breathe. A person doesn't cease to breathe. Apart from God saying so. And every breath in between those two events is supplied by him. He's the source of life itself. Of course he should have kept the son alive, but he chose not to, which is his sovereign right, his sovereign way of working on this occasion. And yet, as with the brook drying up, we have the privilege of knowing what those at the time didn't know. We have the answer, or at least part of the answer, as to the question why. Because look how this passage ends. With the widow saying to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. The widow's trust in God, her confidence in his word, as represented by Elijah, the bearer of that word, is increased by this episode. She would have never have got to that point without this happening, without this event taking place. Of course, you might say, well, shame on her for needing that episode to increase her faith in the Lord. After all, wasn't the jar of flour and the jug of oil enough of a witness to the truth of God's word, enough of a witness to the faithfulness of the Lord? I tell you, it's a brave man or woman who makes that accusation. To my Christian friends, many of us have been walking in the faith far longer than this widow had, and yet the abundance, despite the abundance of God's evidence of his goodness towards us, we still doubt, don't we? We still have so little faith in him, and he uses events to gradually build up our confidence in the God we adore. God graciously ordered events so that this widow's confidence in him would be increased. The event itself is undeniably tragic, but the outcome is undeniably tremendous for her good and God's glory. And part of the lesson of this passage to us lies in this. Christians, I've no doubt that you've all experienced what this widow experienced. Not necessarily the death of a son. Perhaps some of you have. But you've known trials, you've known difficulties, you're experiencing them now, some of you. Sometimes they come upon us so quickly. All seems well, God's blessings are evident, his mercies are new every morning, we adore his faithfulness. But then comes trauma and tragedy. And we wonder why. Well, let me tell you, it's not that he's only in part control of our lives, that he can supply the good but can do nothing about the bad. No, our breath and all our ways are in his hand. And as I said to you before, your circumstances are never outside of the circumference of his sovereignty. And though we might not have a detailed explanation as to why particular calamities come upon us, Romans 8 verse 28 is written in bold letters above the life of every Christian. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. God is ever concerned for his people's good and supremely for his own glory. And he coordinates everything, absolutely everything, according to his master plan. His marvellous purposes will be perfectly fulfilled, albeit from our point of view, in often mysterious ways. As Cooper goes on to say in his hymn, deep in unfathomable minds of never failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. You fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break with blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfold in every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. As one commentator puts it, God provides and perplexes. He blesses and baffles his servants. And that's what the widow was taught early on. But he doesn't do so erratically, irrationally. His faithfulness towards his people is not fitful, meaning you have to hope each morning, well, I hope he's in a good mood today and he's going to bless me today. He is unfailingly faithful. His ways may be mysterious. Perhaps they seem mysterious to you at the moment. Why is he letting me go through this? But they will all be proved to be marvellous in the end. All now mysterious shall be bright at last. The unexplained death of her son. Mysterious. Why? Well, we have the privilege of seeing at least part of the reason. To bless this widow. To increase her faith in the word of the Lord. But let us move on to the next part. The unprecedented, I'm calling it, prayer of Elijah. He's having witnessed the death of the widow's son. We read that the widow, she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You've come to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." She attributed the death of her son not only to the presence of the prophet, but also somehow to her previous sins. Now, I think if we're honest with ourselves, we might say, well, I don't like her tone here. You know, I think of Job and how he responded to even greater adversity than she faced. And I much prefer what he had to say. Do you remember, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Yeah, that's far more spiritual, Job. Not sure about this widow's way of wording things. But I'll say to you, don't be too harsh on her. Don't be so harsh on one so young in the faith. After all, how unlike the response of the world is her response. The typical response of the people of the world to suffering and death is, I haven't done anything to deserve this. But the widow is at least conscious of sin, previous sins that were worthy of condemnation. And she links the death of her son to that. Now perhaps she's misinterpreted events. God does indeed discipline those he loves. He does indeed cause things to happen to us when we have sinned. But I don't think that was the case here. But we must say that she acknowledged what most people deny, her own sinfulness before God. So there she is, her dead son in her arms. The question why, hanging over her. But look at Elijah's response. Now, as I said earlier, it's significant that the word of the Lord did not come to Elijah at this point. But that didn't stop Elijah from going to the Lord of his word. Which is what he did, without a moment's hesitation, without answering even the widow's accusation. He doesn't know why her son's breath has left him, but he knows the one who does, and it is to him that he immediately turns. He said to her, "Give me your son, And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged, and he laid him on his own bed, and he cried to the Lord. And Christians here, I suspect you know what I'm going to say now. The prophet's response is the proper response to perplexing and painful problems. As one commentator again has said, tell me where a man goes in the first hour of sorrow and unsettlement, and I will tell you his character. Tell me where a man goes first in the hour of sorrow and unsettlement, and I will tell you his character. Let me ask you, where do you go first? Where do you go first in such an hour? Or we might eventually get round to prayer, if time permits, once we've panicked a bit, once we've phoned a few people to tell them what's happened, once we've planned our own strategy for coping, for dealing with the problem. But no, tell me where a man goes first in the hour of sorrow and unsettlement, and I will tell you his character. Elijah went first to the Lord. He took it to the Lord in prayer, as we sing. I remember some years ago in our last church receiving a report from some missionaries in Peru, missionaries we supported as a church, and there had been an earthquake in the area where they ministered. And at the time of the quake, there was understandably considerable panic, and we received a letter from one of the missionaries describing the events at the time, and she said how she rushed with another Christian to find this other missionary to see how they were, and they rounded the corner and they saw her amidst all the pandemonium. And where was she? They found her in the street, on her knees, like Elijah, crying out to the Lord. It's a wonderful thing. Whether in 9th century BC Sidon, or 21st century Peru, or let me tell you, in 21st century South Wales. The Lord, with all that name conveys, the great I am, the eternal God, we can turn to him instantly. We don't need to wait until there's network coverage, until we get some spiritual signal. You won't have to listen to some strange music or hear numerous messages as they try to connect you. You don't need to worry about whether the person at the other end is going to be there, or you'll have to leave a voicemail. Wherever, whenever, the child of God can draw near to the throne of grace to receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We can draw near with confidence because of the relationship that we enjoy by grace with this God. Elijah called him, "O Lord, my God." I tell you what fools we are in being so backward in coming forward when we have such a God to pray to. We are the treasured possession of this God. You know, nearly 30 centuries has passed since this event, and so much has changed in the world, but God has not changed. The Lord does not change. And he is there for us to turn to. When blessings come, when tragedy strikes, "Oh Lord, my God, our Father in heaven." Elijah's first response was to pray. Notice how he prays. Notice the concern he had for the widow. Notice the way he identifies her with himself, with her plight, and prays on her behalf. He takes the body from her. He takes it to his own room. He lays it on the bed. He cried to the Lord. He cried to him. This was no going through the motions. This was the pouring out of emotion. This wasn't Elijah simply doing his duty. This was Elijah declaring his distress on behalf of the widow that he lodged with. He cried to the Lord, "Oh Lord, my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourned by killing her son?" Yes, he knew that even this calamity, like everything else, it lay within the circle of God's sovereignty. He didn't think that death had somehow sneaked one past God here, and he better inform God of what had happened. He knew that life and death lie in God's hands, and so God, to God he turns, he pleads on behalf of the widow. Yeah, you know, there's a lesson for us in praying here. In Romans 12, verse 15, we're told that we should rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. It's a simple enough command, isn't it? But it's one we find so difficult to fulfil. Because when others rejoice, we are so often jealously self-interested. And when others weep, we can remain largely disinterested. But not the prophet, and it shouldn't be the case with us, and pray it wouldn't. Pray that we would, like him, truly rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. That when tragedy strikes someone else, when loss strikes them, our hearts would be tender, our hearts would be sympathetic. We would go to God on their behalf, cite in their case, plead in their cause. Oh Lord, my God, on behalf of that person, I feel for them. Oh God. He prayed. How he prayed, but don't fail to notice what he prayed. He stretched himself upon the child 3 times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." I want you to realise that this man Elijah, undoubtedly one of the greatest prophets in the Bible, I want you to notice that he, even he, had no magical powers by which he could perform miracles. He was dependent upon the Lord, as impotent without the Lord as any one of us is. You know, today you'll hear reports of miracle workers and men and women with so-called miracle ministries, and they might refer to God in some way, but you somehow get the impression that, you know, they could get on perfectly well without him, so they thought. My friends, none of us have any intrinsic power that can perform miracles, that can do anything. It is God who performs the miracle here. I believe God can still perform miracles today, but it is God who does it. It is the Lord working through people, and all the glory must go to him. Elijah knew that, and the Apostle Peter knew that after they had healed the lame man outside the temple gate, and all the crowds were watching in amazement. And Peter said to them, "Don't think it's me that's healed this man. It's the name of Jesus." Apart from God, we can do nothing. Elijah knew that. We need to realise that. But we also need to believe what Elijah believed, that not only apart from God we can do nothing, with God all things are possible. He stretched himself upon the child 3 times. Nothing magical about this one. Perhaps the best suggestion you can read is that it was a symbolic act supporting his prayer, as though he was saying, let this lifeless body be like my lively body. And then he cries to the Lord again, "Oh Lord my God, let this child's life come into him again." Now as I referred to this earlier as the unprecedented prayer of Elijah, and I stick with that. Because up until this point in time, we have no record of a dead person being raised to life again. You read through the scriptures and you'll read of many wonderful miracles taking place in the books before we get to 1 Kings. Rivers being parted, seas being parted, people being healed and cured and all sorts of wonderful things. But there could be no greater miracle in the physical realm than this. A dead person being raised to life again. But up until this point, it had not happened. Elijah had no accounts to read of, as we do. No reports to turn to. And yet he believes that for the Lord his God, nothing, absolutely nothing, is impossible. And so he prayed, "Let this child's life come into him again." I tell you, Elijah sets such an example, such a challenge to us in our prayer life. If you go to the book of James, in James chapter 5, you find out of all the people James could have drawn upon to give an example of a man of prayer, he chooses Elijah, a man with a nature like ours. Yes, says James, but he was a man, the prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. He points us to Elijah, to this man of prayer. We see that he prayed. That was his first response to adversity. We see how he prayed, how he identified himself with the widow's cause. But see what he prayed for. That life would return to a dead body. Yes, we might remember Elijah for the Carmel conquest. But I suggest to you that Elijah should equally be remembered for this unprecedented prayer. A prayer that raises the question. A prayer that provokes the question, Christian. How big is your God? How big is your God? Is your God dwarfed by the problems that you encounter in your life? You might think so by the way we sometimes react to those problems. Is he dwarfed by them? Or does he, like Elijah's God, tower over them with the skyscraper of his sovereignty? Able, yes, able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think. See this man. See what he prayed for. Let this child's life come into him again. The unexplained death of the son. The unprecedented prayer of Elijah. But we end up thirdly with the unlimited power of the Lord. The unlimited power of the Lord. We read in verse 22, the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. You think of the contents of that verse. You think of what the profoundness of what is being said there. And yet it's said so simply, the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. The great and eternal I am listened to the voice of this man. And the life of the child came into him again and he revived. The lifeless body became a lively being. His breath, once removed, is now restored. No doctors are involved. No follow-up health care is necessary. He has an instant recovery. It's stated so simply in verse 22. And don't you try to overcomplicate it, as you might be tempted to do so. This is to be simply received. Simply believed. God hears the earnest prayers of his people, my friends. The Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and he listens to each one of his children. However many may be praying to him at any one time around the globe, he hears each one individually. His throne is in the heavens, but that is a throne of grace. And it is ever occupied by our God. He is never absent. He never goes AWOL. You'll never get an answer phone message saying, you know, he's away, but he'll get back to you when he returns. You won't have to go through some receptionist who's trying to filter his calls. You don't have to work your way through a maze of possible options. Dial 1 for this or 4 for that. The Lord personally, the Lord immediately, hears the cries of his children. And you might not have anyone else to talk to. But when you have such a God as this, who do you need to talk to? For the Lord who personally listens is the Lord whose power is unlimited. Just remember the context of this chapter. Israel was chasing after Baal, a heathen fertility god associated with the giving of life. Baal should have sent the rain, supposedly, but the drought imposed by the Lord was already beginning to show Baal to be the fate that he was. Elijah goes to Sidon, the heart of Baal-worshipping country. He arrives at this place called Zarephath. He meets his once Baal-worshipping widow who puts her trust in Elijah's God. And she regularly receives what he's promised to give her. Food to eat every day. But then suddenly, dramatically, she loses her precious, probably her only son. And the question is, was she right after all to trust in the Lord? Or should she have stuck with Baal? Should she have given him another chance? Yes, the Lord had saved her household from near death. But can he save from death itself? Who is the real God? The Lord or Baal? At Mount Carmel, that's what would be at stake. That's the question that would need to be answered. That's the contest that would need to be won. Who is the real God? But even before that most public event, in this little house in Zarephath, in this little household, God orders circumstances to teach this woman that the Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Her initial loss was for her eternal gain as she comes to a greater realization of who Elijah's God and her God is. He's the infinite one. He's the living and true God. He's the one who holds in his hand our breath and all our ways. He's the God who himself, some 900 years later, would come into this world in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, one who would die and who would himself be raised from the dead that he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil. and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. We cannot read of this resurrection without our thoughts going ahead to the one himself who raised men and women from the dead, but far more significantly was himself raised from the dead after his death on the cross for sinners like us. The one whose resurrection guarantees, I tell you, guarantees our future resurrection. The one who declares to all who would listen to him in faith, fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Jesus Christ, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by his death and resurrection has conquered death, has conquered Satan, and has the keys, has the power, has the authority over death and Hades themselves. And he says, fear not. To all who would listen to him, fear not. He has removed the very sting from death itself. Thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. The passage ends with Elijah coming down the stairs. He'd taken the corpse of the boy from the widow and had gone upstairs, but now he comes back down from his chamber with a living child and delivers him back to his mother with the words, "See, your son lives," to which she responds, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." The unexplained death of the son. Yes, God works in mysterious ways. The unprecedented prayer of Elijah. What a man of faith. The unlimited power of the Lord. He speaks and listening to his voice. New life the dead receive. Elijah's faith has been shown. The widow's faith has grown. But above all, God's faithfulness shines forth. The Lord, he is God. And if he is your God this morning, you can depend upon him to do what is right for you, to work all things together for your good. You may be in the dark, but he never is. His ways may be mysterious, but they are always marvellous. You cannot fathom, but you can put your faith in him, because he always does what is right. This mighty God works through the mundane, yes, the mundane everyday affairs of our life, and he works through the most significant moments of our life to fulfill his marvellous purposes. Turn to him. Trust in him. Speak with him often. Live for his glory. Apart from him, we can do nothing. But I tell you, with him, all things are possible.